Good morning. Today is Monday, the 20th of November. Joining us this morning, I guess just Troy Nicolini. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
I'm not sure what you are today.
And I get to disclaim that I just was notified like 10 minutes ago, right?
Yeah.
Then. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm a fill-in.
What was it like? Was it Face the Nation? Spontaneous and unrehearsed?
That's what this is.
Every freaking morning.
I can probably think of one more adjective to describe it. But
yeah, you know, and that's a long list, though. Depending on who you talk to and when you talk to them. Is it before the show or after the show? Things change. All right, are you ready for our, we're into customs now, just to kind of warn you properly. Why do or did men wear neckties? Not that either of us are today.
I just always assumed it was to cover up the dribbled food that would have been down the front of your shirt, but that's...
A napkin, yeah.
That's the only thing I can come up with.
That's kind of where I am too. Roman soldiers wore a strip of cloth around their necks to keep them warm in winter and to absorb sweat in the summer. Other armies followed suit, and during the French Revolution, the royalists... And the rebels used ties to display the colors of allegiance. They borrowed the design and the name cravat from the Croatian army. Later, ties became a French fashion statement, offering a splash of color to an otherwise drab wardrobe.
Wow.
Has nothing to do with being piggy eaters.
I don't mind a tie, but they sometimes give me a headache because they're...
Well, you're not supposed to do them that tight, dude.
Well, that's
you don't cut the
mistake.
Blood off to the head.
Clearly, I don't know how to tie or wear a tie.
Yeah, your dad didn't talk to you about that one, huh?
No.
Yeah. I get dizzy from wearing a tie. Oh, that's funny. Oh, gosh. How's the house coming along?
Good.
The remodeling?
Yeah, it's pretty much done.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we talked about boats in the past and houses, so I figure that all that stuff is kind of fun. Is it my imagination, or is Woodley Island, or whatever they call it these days?
That, the name of that one hasn't changed.
And Indian Island.
That one's changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has there been this work that people are doing out there? Is it, what's going on? Are they trying to, like, keep the water away, channel it? Canals?
Okay. You're talking about the invasive species removal project out there. You see the big...
Oh, of course. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking
well,
about.
That's what they're
I just
doing.
See a bunch of digging going on and wonder what's
well, they
story.
Have equipment out there and they have personnel with, you know, like a really cool looking track driven mowing device. And then they've got folks with like line cutters, you know, weed whackers.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, this is not my area of expertise, but I believe they're removing Spartina grass, which is invasive, and it anchors the
mud?
The soil in a way that's not natural and doesn't allow normal processes to occur. And so by removing it, they're allowing it to sort of, well, they're allowing the natives to recolonize and then they interact better with the water and the ecosystem to create habitat for the native species.
So was this stuff put in by like the guy that had the house out there where the rookery is?
I don't know how that
to stabilize
I don't know how that stuff got here. I mean, that's how ice plant got here, you know, was to stabilize shorelines. Turns out it's kind of a disaster, right?
Yeah, it's pretty.
Although I heard ice plant in San Francisco was put there so that the troops could be camouflaged while defending against, you know, intruders during World War II. I don't know if that's
really.
A rumor.
I was thinking of using that as landscaping material, ground cover,
like ice plant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a little bit of yellow here and a little bit of pink there. It's pretty.
It spreads really. It's amazing how ice plant can spread. But we
good. So I might not be able to kill it.
It's really hard. I mean, you have to yank it
it's
out.
Right up there with blackberries?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I hate Himalayan blackberries. We have our Fairhaven properties right on the bay, and it's vulnerable to coastal erosion during the storm when the storms come through, even though it's on the bay side, not the ocean side. And someone in the past had planted ice plant all on that beach, thinking it would kind of armor the beach and protect
lock
it from
it
erosion.
In. Yeah.
But ironically, it sort of has a weird negative impact because it anchors one little spot, and then... What doesn't happen is sand doesn't get moved up into the back part of the property. So we took a section out.
So it's like a shield almost?
It's a shield, yeah. And so we took a section out just as an experiment. And it's incredible. When that southeast wind blows as the fronts move into the wintertime, that blows sand off the beach. And now it goes right over where the ice plant was before, up onto our property. And it's grown the property depth by about a foot and a half. in 3 years in that one section. And all the rest of the Fairhaven Beach is still, the sand just hits the ice plant, bounces off, and goes back in the water. So it's actually interesting how that one plant can mess up the normal dune formation process. Like the big dunes on the ocean side,
right,
that's when the north winds all summer long blowing from the north-northwest, and that blows sand up off the beach into the dry environment, and then it keeps moving, and that's why you get the undulating dune formation. And so that's
how... Well, and the whole Lamphere Dune.
Exactly.
That whole...
Yeah.
And for folks that are unfamiliar, that big massive dune that's at the north end of the North Spit.
And there's places where you can see that process happening. Like the dunes are literally moving, and you can see sand on a windy day blowing down the backside of a dune, and it's basically moving sand inland.
Looks like a desert.
Yeah, and that actually protects us from winter storms. So on a smaller scale on the bayside, we saw that unfolding, and it was really cool pulling that ice plant out. Actually, I should say a group of Cal Poly students did that.
Oh, it wasn't the Nicolini family?
Well, I was there with them, but it was actually my proposal to have these students do something positive and uplifting, because they were in a class learning about sea level rise and climate change and all the negative impacts. And my premise was, like, you know, the world changes around you. You can either get really depressed about it and, like, you know... Go in the corner and cry and lose hope. Right. Or you can say, what the heck can I do about this? And I felt like they needed something tangible they could actually physically do to get some of their anxiety and frustration out. So I invited them out. I was a guest speaker on this course.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were taking the class or
not. No, I was a guest speaker. And that's when I saw they were just like, oh, like so terrified of the future. And I think if your youth is terrified of the future, that's the end. Like,
that's not positive at all, no.
And so they all came out and they had shovels and picks, and we dug up some ice plant. And then I sent them pictures of the sand moving back into the higher dunes and how we restore these natural processes that will protect our shoreline, right? And I don't know if they had...
Did you invite them back?
I have invited them back, yeah. And I've had a few back.
And now they're too happy. They don't worry about it.
Yeah, they haven't come out with a shovel. But I don't know. It was a nice way to kind of have them do something that was... give them hope and optimism for the future instead of doom and gloom.
Well, and I mean, you can see that beach I would go to on a very regular basis was Trinidad. In the middle of wintertime after a good storm, you'd see the redwood stumps down there in the flat.
Yeah, that's...
And then, you know, the rocks are these big, massive things in the middle of summertime.
That's when the sand builds
it's back. It's all covered up, or it's like a five-foot rock.
And that's a natural seasonal cycle that you're seeing.
Okay. Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about chicken of the sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets. More than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. So, Troy, the concept of sand dune and dune management, obviously there's interaction with tides and all that kind of stuff. You had mentioned as we were going to break that what we see at Trinidad State Beach is, obviously it's natural and it's normal because it's happening unaided. But it's amazing to me how alive, if you will, the beach is. It is literally, it's different every week or two. Things change really significantly based on the storms.
Yeah, especially during the transition seasons, like, you know, like in the first fall storms, you can just see a profound dramatic change in just a handful of days. If we get big long period waves, they essentially carve all the sand out that's been piled up during the summer northerly winds.
Where does it go?
So it moves offshore and forms shoals just outside the breaker line. And that's actually...
Oh.
Yeah. And so that's why if you look really carefully, now you'll see this. I promise you'll see this now that I mention it. But if you stand on the beach in the wintertime in a big wave event and you look at the waves breaking right on the beach and allow your gaze to drift farther offshore, you'll see that the waves go quiet, like they don't seem to be breaking. And then quite a ways offshore, you'll see them breaking
again. Yes.
That's the shoal. That's what they're breaking.
Oh, so that's where it's being deposited.
Yeah. It's moves offshore. And it actually has a pretty significant impact on two things. The most important one, you know, for me is
boats.
Beach. Well, beach. No, actually, three impacts. I haven't thought of that. Yeah, no, actually, thank you. The one is like for beach safety, because if you're used to a beach in the summer, it's got that nice gradual beach slope. The wave, like
the Southern California beach.
Yeah, like concept. Like, yeah. Even one given beach can be have that mild slope in the summer, and then suddenly it's steep, and that means that the wave energy can propagate farther up on the beach. And if it does, like say, knock you down and pull you into the water, you're in head over water very quickly.
Really quick. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the real danger.
Well, it's like the big lagoon.
Big lagoon scenario, right? Becomes really steep. Yeah. And so that's one issue, and the other one is coastal erosion, right? Once the summertime beach is gone, then everything's vulnerable to the larger waves coming farther inland and causing
more because it's more exposed.
Yeah, and then that shoal, it's interesting because in the wintertime, sometimes we'll get that big shoal, and then we can get wave days where there's a lot of small waves, and then every so often some big waves, sets of waves. And surfers look for those because they're typically good surfing waves,
right?
Because they happen when the interval between the waves is really long. And so if you're a boat and you're traveling over that shallow environment and you're not aware of it because the ocean looks pretty calm and it's getting shallower, but you're not thinking or too worried about it, and then a set comes through, you can suddenly be in breaking waves pretty far off from shore. Like, you wouldn't think you were surf zone. Yeah. And actually, I've talked to a couple different folks in crab boats that lost a boat. He got rolled in one of those waves.
Wow.
And others have, like, you know, suddenly found themselves in breaking waves because sometimes they come in pretty shallow to work their crab gear. And kayakers, like really experienced sea kayakers, know to stay the hell away from those shoals if there's long period waves and therefore likely set behavior.
Oh, so they'll stay away rather than try to ride them in?
Yeah, because most sea kayakers are out there in touring kayaks trying to enjoy nature, not thrill. I mean, there's also sea kayakers who are trying to surf waves.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that formation of the beach changing throughout the year can have a lot of impacts on folks.
Now, with the so when the sand gets thrown up on the beach.
Yeah.
That's where the supply is, so to speak, of that sand?
The supply is, it can be offshore a little ways, or it can be south or north, because there's also sand moving north.
That's what I was saying, the Eel River mouth.
Yep. A lot of our sand comes from the Eel, moves to the north. It hits the south jetty and piles up. That's why there's a huge beach always in the south jetty.
Right.
And then some of it wraps around the jetties and gets pushed out and deposits and forms the shoal that causes the problem for, you know, boats going in and out.
And that's what gets dredged by.
And then that gets dredged. Yeah. And some of it makes it around the jetties and then keeps going north. And sometimes the sediment actually moves to the south. We have a really dynamic section of beach between, you know, basically like Table Bluff and Trinidad. The sand is moving north sometimes and south sometimes. And the only thing that interrupts its natural progression is our jetties. Otherwise, it would just
fill in and drain out.
Be super happy. Yeah.
The Mad River. Yeah. Does that have a lot of sediment that dumps in? Yeah, you don't hear about it.
You know, not compared to the Eel, partly just because of the flow volume, and also the Eel, just by the nature of the geology that the Eel flows through, it has a really high sediment load for the amount of water flowing out.
You see like a cross section of the, not foundational stone, come on. Wait, how much is fill?
Yeah, oh, right.
Yeah, the bedrock. Duh. You see how much. It's just, it's sediment, you know?
Yeah, and all that's vulnerable to erosion and it ends up,
you know, yeah.
And then with, you know, seismically active area, every time there's an earthquake, you shake things loose and then they're vulnerable to being.
Is there a lot of sediment that comes in after an earthquake?
It would make
sense.
Yeah, you get landslides and, you know. And so the Eel is particularly good at producing sediment, but the Mad, if you've ever seen it flow, it's chocolate milk in the winter, so it produces sediment too. But I've never seen the numbers on the sediment load and the volume relative to the Eel, but it seems like it's...
Yeah, there's never a comparison between the two.
Yeah, but it contributes to the sand load on our beaches.
Well, and that mouth moves so much.
It does, which has always been intriguing to me, because it seems like it migrates to the north until it gets too far, and then it snaps back to the south.
Yeah, it's like it runs out of energy or something.
Yeah, yeah. I've always been intrigued by that process.
That Clam Beach, though, is such a long wave slope. Does it ever... I mean, with these storms, it doesn't seem like it reacts
really
the same
down.
Way.
I think it's partly because its orientation is such that it's sheltered from the really big northwest waves that come in the winter.
So the Trinidad Head kind of protects it?
Yeah, it kind of breaks it up. And then I'm not sure why it doesn't get steep. I never really thought about it. It's a good observation. You're right. That one always stays flat. And by the way, to my knowledge, we've never had a sneaker wave death on Clam Beach. So I always tell folks, flatter beaches seem to be a lot safer. Yeah, even if you do get knocked down by a wave, you can stand up.
Yeah, so
whereas
it's
in Big
just
Lagoon,
right there.
If you get knocked down by a wave, you're treading water.
You're SOL real quick, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's not a typo, by the way. KINS, news and information time, it's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, news and information time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. You want to talk weather just a little bit?
Yeah.
Why do we get weather like we are having right now, this time of the year and in January and February? Is it tied to the migration of the jets? Jet stream.
Well,
or the ocean current, the Alaskan current?
Jet stream's a good term.
Is it still in vogue?
Oh, absolutely. It's still a physical thing, in fact.
Okay. Well, I thought it got renamed something.
I think you're thinking of maybe the atmospheric river.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same thing?
No. Atmospheric river is a plume of moisture that comes up from below our latitude and it's injected into our environment and creates a lot of rain, typically.
You mean the Pineapple Express?
Yeah, thank you.
Is that what it was?
Yes. Same.
Okay.
Yeah, atmospheric river and Pineapple Express. But the jet stream has always been the jet stream, and it's that ribbon of high velocity air high up in the atmosphere that kind of snakes around the North Pacific, and it moves
That's
south.
What you see on the TV.
TV meteorologists love to say the jet stream has moved south over our area. Yeah, essentially, it brings the storm track our way. And so, in fact, we're in an El Nino this year, and as I approach later years in life, I have a hard time remembering things. Maybe others do too, so I'll show you my little trick for remembering this. El Nino rhymes with San Diego. And so the jet stream heads south in El Nino years.
It's going to San Diego.
Yes. Yep. So you can picture that ribbon of high velocity air up in the atmosphere, and it's either up around Seattle or possibly as far down as San Diego. And in El Nino years, it tends to be...
It'll go as deep as San Diego?
Well, it's sort of like where the rain goes. It may not get that far, but that's like where the rain hits Southern California in that region during El Nino years. And then La Niña's, it tends to go up north like Seattle.
Okay. And so that's when we get our dry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, we're in the middle, and so it's always wide open for us. There's not a really super tight correlation.
Really?
Yeah, it's unfortunate in some ways because people always want to ask us, like, what kind of winter are we going to have?
Wet year, dry year.
Yeah, we hear it's a really strong El Nino. Tell us what's going to happen. And you know, we have to say, well, if you're in Seattle or San Diego, we can tell you what's going to happen.
We're in the sphere of influence.
We're just in this weird transitionary. So, like, some of our largest storms on record were in La Niña's, and some of our largest storms on record were in El Niño's at this latitude. And that's not true if you go to San Diego or Seattle. There's much tighter correlation between what happens.
So is this the marine influence from the ocean that's doing this? I mean, if we were not Humboldt County, but let's say we were Lassen County.
Yeah.
A lot more consistent connection to whether it's a law or an L?
Well, part of the answer to that question is yes, it's the ocean conditions, but not right off our beach. And so no, it's more latitudinal. Like if you go inland from here, it would be ambiguous during a La Niña or El Niño. And if you go up to Boise, Idaho, you'd have a wetter winter, you know, during a La Niña. So, I wanted to say something that you made me think of, which is, it'll come back to me.
Two old guys get together, what the heck?
Well, I had to answer your question first, and then it just cleared out my memory. Oh, I know. Interestingly, at the shift briefing this morning, 7 a.m., we have a shift change, you know, and one of the meteorologists was conjecturing that maybe the warm water offshore was somehow influencing. Our systems keep getting stalled out and weakening as they come on shore. We keep it
historically?
Last couple of weeks, like, you know, So it's like, why do they keep dissipating and weakening as they come on shore? And one of them said, well, maybe it's the warm water off our shore. And then, you know, others said, wait, doesn't warm water enhance that process? So, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, never mind.
Yeah.
So we're always looking for logical association.
You guys must have really cool water cooler discussions then, or round tables.
No, the best part is our Christmas party where we all talk about the weather.
Oh.
You think I'm kidding?
No. I can see it happen. I mean, you get a bunch of geeks on whatever the topic is, and that's
happens. I mean, scientists, a fair percentage of scientists are introverts, and so, you know.
And that's where your passion is.
Well, and that's where the passion is, so it's natural.
What I would find curious?
Yeah.
Your spouses, or boyfriends and girlfriends, okay, what do they think, or what do they talk about, or if they, you know, they're over on one side of the room, and you all are on another side of the room.
This is where I look to your son here and ask for a commercial break here, so I don't have to answer that question.
And he's off doing something. Yeah. No, sorry, no life draft out of this one.
Yeah.
You're just going to stall it out. Okay.
I'm going to stall that one out. No, my wife loves my coworker. I'm just kidding. But she has commented that, you know, the gatherings are... that they talk about weather, and she's commented on that. So that's as much as I'll say. Yeah.
Well,
interestingly, your coworkers talk about weather when they get together. But, you know, if you're engineers and you get together, what are you going to talk about?
Yeah.
Engineering. If you're, when you get to, Christmas party with a bunch of broadcasters, what do you all talk about?
Oh, I do weird stuff. You know me. I'm not going to do normal things.
So you don't talk about broadcasting and transmitter frequencies and the cost of leases for transmitter stations?
I would either be sitting in the corner by myself.
Oh, okay.
Or there would be so much alcohol having to flow that nobody could leave.
I mean, no. Okay.
No.
That's fair.
No, we don't have too many of the engineering types. You know, I think folks would be surprised at the variety.
Oh, okay.
That we have.
Yeah.
You know, you guys pretty much have a department, right?
Well, we...
Weather.
Well,
you know, and we've got so many facets.
Yeah, to be a meteorologist, you're right. We have a filtering process. Someone has to, at some point in their life, they are intrigued by weather, and then they have to find out that they're pretty good at math and science. And by then, yeah, so there's some filtering that produces meteorologists, right?
That's why I end up in the parking lot when I come out and visit you. Good math. Okay, I'm out.
But you're right. I mean, in fact, my wife's, she owns a small business, and the small business community is much more diverse and eclectic because it draws from all types of sectors. But you kind of have to go through a boot camp to become a meteorologist or an engineer, and so there's some filtering there.
As long as you don't have to go into the water for a long period of time.
Right.
So dune dynamics, is that part of what the background is for meteorologists?
Absolutely not. Most meteorologists don't study marine meteorology or certainly coastal processes. But remember, my background is civil engineering, and I was a coastal engineer specifically.
Right.
So that's why I'm super into it.
I figured that was a safe question because you're not...
Yeah.
Pouncing on that, you know, on everybody else with that one.
Yeah, most the world of meteorology is really about tornadoes and hurricanes and winter storms, and so...
Atmospheric things.
Yeah. In fact, the only folks that we get applied to our office who are passionate about marine meteorology, you know, from a young age, are surfers. And we have one on our staff now. And,
really?
Yeah, he grew up in San Diego surfing, and when he was like, what do I want to do with my life? I want to learn more about waves. What causes waves? Wind. What causes wind? Pressure differences. Wow, this is so cool. I want to be a meteorologist.
So he walked it up from water.
Yeah, but in general, you find very few meteorologists who are naturally super excited about marine. Some become really excited about it as they learn about it, and it's an amazing field of study. But no university program that I know of infuses marine meteorology into their training. It's just not part of the program for some reason.
That's intriguing because would think, you know, if there was a commitment to impact...
Well,
that's there, just like...
No, you're right.
Soils also.
Yeah, no, you're right. But it's a marine impact. And so there's oceanographers who study this stuff. But interestingly,
So oceanographers do...
Yeah.
Study meteorology.
No, well, they study the ocean, and that part of it, they may drift into the atmosphere. But the point I was going to make is that whenever you're on a landmass near an ocean, it makes the weather more moderate. Because the big body of water next to us... It tempers our temperature fluctuations and in every way moderates our weather. And so it isn't...
So something like Hawaii, though, it's so tiny compared to the space that it's in.
Yeah, really in a marine weather environment, yeah. But look at our temperature fluctuations. All you have to do is go 2 hours inland and they get really freezing cold temperatures and really hot temperatures. And our temperature stays moderate and it's because of the ocean next to us. So my point of that is that, you know, from atmospheric science departments who are studying weather... They're looking to the really impactful weather.
We're kind of boring.
We're boring. Yeah. I mean, actually, it's one of my challenges of keeping staff is that by some measures, our weather is less exciting than weather, if, you know, say in in the Midwest.
Really?
Where oh my gosh, they have hurricanes, they have tornadoes.
I guess that's gotta be upbringing. Yeah, there's no way. Tornadoes? I want to be, no. Let's talk about buoys. But for, I don't want tornadoes, buoys.
But for a meteorologist, tornadoes are incredibly interesting and exciting to study and forecast. And I'll give you an analogy when we come back from the commercial break about like going to the desert versus like a tropical rainforest, like
okay,
and why some people do come to love our weather here.
See, Winston showed up to save your buns.
Yes.
Timing is a little
weird. Well, remind me what we were going to talk about.
Yeah, Christmas parties. It's 844.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft salad dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini, regular guy.
Regular guy.
You need a business card. Regular guy. You said before the break you want some of the differences of patterns in deserts versus what we were accustomed
to. Yeah, and I might have thought even a better analogy actually during the break, which is some people will say that we don't have seasons here in Humboldt County, right? Like, we don't have really clean, profound...
We have wet, dry...
Yeah, right.
Fog, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, compared to, say, like, New England, where there's the foliage, you know.
Yes, yes.
But if you lived here and you love it and you've been here long enough, you realize, you start to see our seasons. They're just more subtle and muted, but they're beautiful in their own way.
Yeah.
And I would say the meteorologists who come here to the coast and do meteorology start to see the beauty and the subtle differences in the weather, and they are, you know, they like it just as much as other folks get excited about tornadoes and hurricane. They get excited about our weather. And those are the folks who decide to stay and make a career here, mixed with a wonderful quality of life and access to outdoor, you know, activities.
But the dramatic changes.
Yeah, we don't have those. But right. And the desert analogy, if you've ever loved the desert, you know, some people might say, like, the desert, there's nothing but cactus and rocks. No, there's so much in the desert. But you have to look.
Scorpions.
Scorpions and snakes.
Yes.
But you have to look for it. To see its beauty versus, like, you
well,
know.
Yeah, and to survive.
Yeah, and to survive. Yeah, look in your boot before you slip it on in the morning.
Yes.
But, you know, a tropical rainforest, everything's in your face and it's loud and colorful. But so it's just different.
And just as poisonous.
And just as
there's
poisonous.
A reason why I'm here.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's kind of the, that's the sort of Zen Buddhist attitude I have towards our weather and seasons. But we do find folks that love the weather here. But many of the folks who come here as meteorologists from other parts of the country eventually want to go back home, closer to family, and back to where the weather's really exciting.
Or for them, normal.
And the what?
Normal.
And the normal.
For them.
Normal for them, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I would think that if you were on the coast, you would have been raised on the coast. That's what is normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than, you know, you go to the Midwest.
Right. But one of our folks came from Minnesota, and it seems like the minute, and she came here as an entry level Met, but I think the minute she set foot in this region, she fell in love with it.
Look,
and
no snow shovels.
She took up She took up surfing, you know, and she loves this area, and her family's still in Minnesota, but you know, she's actually married and has a son now here, and so she's staying, and so some people fall in love with it.
Get smart,
even if they're from the Midwest. Yeah.
In the past, we've talked about the buoys, that was really trying to get more information, more information, more information.
Right.
But that's water, not atmosphere.
Right.
So you mentioned earlier that a lot of meteorology is above in the air rather than below in the water.
Right.
Is there a push? Is NOAA doing more of the buoys to get more of that information because of that zone where the two interact?
Yeah, buoys are super important for the West Coast because all of our weather comes across the ocean. So if we're sitting in, you know, Denver, there's a bunch of observations, radar. And,
if you have a buoy in Colorado,
yeah.
It's really been a high
No,
time.
I mean, if you're doing weather forecasting in Colorado,
oh, okay.
you can see it because the weather comes from the West. You can see it moving across the continent, measurements and observations, and there's so much information. But everything that hits us is coming across the ocean. And so we have satellite and we have some radar, but we have very few observations. So I'm just backing up your point. The buoys are really important for us. They're also brutally expensive because they have to be serviced by pretty large ships that need to go 600 miles out in the ocean and, you know, deploy these buoys. And we don't have those ships scattered all over the coast.
So when you hear these discussions about these windmills offshore,
yeah,
and how it's going to pencil out, and do you take it with a grain of sand?
Well, I'm an engineer by training.
Right, so you've got that experience also, or background.
Well, so the interesting thing about engineers, and that now I might get myself in trouble with all my fellow, well, you know, I don't practice engineering now professionally.
You're safe.
As my primary
job. You're not certified.
But the best trait to have as an engineer, in my opinion, is humility, because as soon as you're cocky, you know, and I'm just mentioning this, that in really hostile environments, I don't know. I haven't looked at the engineering, but I know it's challenging. I've deployed buoys, too, in this environment, and it's really challenging to keep them out there. But engineers can do pretty much almost whatever society asks them to do, as long as they're willing to spend the money, because engineering is really a blend of economics and science. Anybody could build a bridge, I would offer, right? They could build a bridge that's way overbuilt and it would never fall down, but they wasted a lot of money. Or they could build a bridge that's underbuilt and falls down in a year, right?
And it wasn't, waste a lot of money.
And waste a lot of money, because they'd have to build it again and people might have died. So engineering is about finding the sweet spot where you build it just big enough to survive without wasting a lot of money. And so I would offer that's going to be the challenge for any deployment of, you know, floating wind turbines in the ocean. Yes, it's going to be a challenging engineering undertaking that will be a balance between science and cost.
Is there any thought to put any weather monitoring devices on top of these things?
Ooh, that's a great thought.
All right, there you go. We got one. Thanks for coming by, bud. See everybody tomorrow.